get serious about building content sites and building a profitable business online? Welcome to the Niche Website Builders Podcast. We bring you the latest field-tested tips, tricks, and strategies for building a profitable online asset. We interview industry experts, share customer success stories, and reveal our own experiences working on hundreds of sites to inspire and motivate you to make something happen. Let's do this.
Hey, and welcome to this week's episode of the Niche Website Builder Podcast. It's me and Mark back here again. We thought we'd jump back on the intro of the podcast last week. I mean, since James took over the show, it's grown massively. We've got a ton of new listeners and some new audience, so we thought we would introduce ourselves again. We're probably going to do this for every episode going forward now. It's really awesome to get back involved in the podcast. If you are listening and you're expecting James, don't worry. James is coming up shortly, he's got an awesome guest planned for you. I'm excited for this episode. We just thought we'd tell you a little bit about what we're doing this week, because we're working on some exciting stuff. We've got some exciting live streams coming up, and we've also got some exciting deals, because it's Black Friday. It's still Black Friday's going on. So, Mark, what have we got going on the live stream this week?
Yeah, so as of today, you just missed, but you can go back and watch it on the channel. We analyzed 5,000 content sites, and this is what we found. So this is our big data project where we've essentially analyzed a bunch of sites to answer the age old question, like, you know, how much did it take for me to get to $1,000 a month or $2,000 a month? So we've done that kind of analysis to work out, you know, on average, how many posts do I need? On average, what authority do I need in this niche to achieve $1,000 a month? So we've checked that out if that's something that's interesting to you. That was recorded as a live stream today. And also top tier links, using data to create stories journalists love. That's the one that's coming up on Thursday this week. So again, we've recently launched our digital PR service. It's amazing. It's just been going absolutely fantastically. We've been getting literally the world's best backlinks for our customers and for our own sites as well. And we're loving it, to be honest. We've got Jake, who's leading up our digital PR service. He's coming to talk to us about using data to create stories that you can then put in front of journalists in order to get some some links, essentially, but some coverage. There's also if you're new to it, we also had a video a few weeks back. You can search the channel for, which was digital PR for niche sites. So this is kind of an intro in really like how we go about tackling digital PR when thinking about content sites. So that's something you can look at too. That's it for now.
Cool. If you want to see those, you can just head on over to YouTube, search for Niche Website Builders, look on our channel. All the live streams are available to watch after they've been streamed as live, so you can go and find them on there. And also, I mean, it wouldn't be complete unless I mentioned Black Friday. It's probably been a crazy week so far. Black Friday's been live for about a week now, but there's still time. If you haven't grabbed one of our offers, go and grab one. We've got 20% more content on all content packages. So whether you want a one-off content package, whether you want a monthly subscription, whether you want us to build one of the done-for-you websites, whether you want to use content for one of our age domains, whatever kind of content you want to order for us, you get 20% more content until Black Friday, which runs out soon. So don't hesitate. And also, like Mark mentioned, our digital PR service, we're also running a Black Friday deal on that. So you get 5% off your monthly subscriptions. Or if you commit to a three-month campaign and you pay up front, you get 7.5% off. Or if you commit to two campaigns up front and pay up front for 6 months, you get 10% off. So if you're thinking about giving your link building switching around your link building, taking it to the next level, wanting to get publications and links in those top tier websites, then honestly, now's the time to load up on this stuff at the end of the year and basically get your site off to a great start ready for 2023. Hope you enjoy the show that James has got planned for you. The guest looks awesome. I know I'll be listening to it later and enjoying it. But for now, that's it from me, Mark. See you next week.
Great. Thank you. Enjoy the show.
Bye, guys.
Welcome to the Niche Website Builders Podcast. Today, we have Paul Limley, and we jumped straight into this podcast. No real introduction. We were kind of chatting away and just started to record. Just because there was a lot of good stuff that we were covering before the podcast anyway. But we jump into his portfolio of sites. So Paul doesn't just run one or two websites. He's literally launch a portfolio of 50 websites, so 10 websites per quarter. And he also has a previous portfolio of around 12 or 16 sites. So he's just, he's managing a lot of websites, which is crazy. And so he dives into his processes and how he's hiring writers and editors for his website. So he's already got 12 editors and 50 writers on his staff. And then you go into, we go into a little bit on portfolio approaches, how it differs from someone who's just kind of starting or writing on one or two websites, how you, your niche selection kind of changes there, some of the experiments he's doing across those sites, and then where he's headed in the future. So sit back and enjoy.
This episode is brought to you by Niche Website Builders, an agency dedicated to helping people just like you build profitable content sites. Niche Website Builders are the hands-off content site marketing agency you always wished existed. It's run by content site marketers for content site marketers, and they help both investors and individuals alike build profitable online properties. They provide a fully outsourced approach to content creation, link building, and done-for-you website builds, the same approach they use on their own six-figure portfolios. For example, their content packages come with a proprietary keyword research process, are written by in-house native English speakers, formatted using templates proven to convert, and uploaded to WordPress with affiliate links added so that all you need to do is hit the publish button. Check them out at nichewebsite.builders/show. That's nichewebsite.builders/show and fill out the form to get coupon codes for 10% more content or a 10% discount on links with your first order sent right to your inbox.
About the writers and things like that, with paying the flat rate plus the, I guess, bonuses on top of that, it's such a good way of always retaining the writers as well. I know you've got a huge portfolio in that area, and obviously you've had to bring in a lot of writers and retain them. I guess, as you mentioned, is that one of the ways you're looking to retain a lot of your writers?
Yeah, it was sort of the model that we created is helping us retain writers and retain the good ones, especially because we're launching 10 per quarter, 10 sites per quarter for 15 months, so 50 total sites. And
that's just nuts, eh?
You know, I thought it was nuts when I first, when we were like kind of modeling it between me and my business partners. And we started off thinking like 16 was a good number, maybe 24. And then we, and then we just like said, fuck it. Let's, can I swear on the podcast?
Yeah, of course.
Fuck it. Let's double that and see what, just see what the model looks like and go from there. And we got to 50 and we're like, okay, we can launch these at X dollar amount with, you know, with our model getting to as close to topical authority as early as possible, maturing over 12 to 15 months, launching ads at 9 months, launching affiliates at 15. Like, you know, it just made sense to do more because it's the fire bullets than cannonballs model. And we'd rather take more shots on goal and see what happens. So,
damn. Okay. So we started this podcast as a good model of storytelling, where you start telling the story in the middle of the story, and then you go back, and that hooks people in. So, do you want to maybe come? We'll bring it back and be like, okay, how did you get started and decide on launching 50 sites or 10 sites per quarter? And then maybe you want to dive into how the hell you're even managing to do that.
Yeah. Well, so my business, Digital Authority Group, we got started, me and my business partner, one of my business partners, Mike, we used to play spike ball, and we would talk business ideas, and COVID hit, and we were like, we kind of reconnected and talked shop a bit. And I told him about some digital things, and including some acquisition strategies, and we just started vetting businesses that we saw on the market, on a bunch of marketplaces, and we're like, okay, let's try to formalize this into a business and a partnership, get some funding. So we raised some funding. We ended up finding some good opportunities, got some under LOI, lost out on some. And then we came across a 12 site portfolio, a 2 site portfolio, and a single site that just, it made sense to acquire them, you know. So 15 total sites we acquired in early 2021, wow. Across, and wide swath of niches, wide swath of strategies. A lot of them are product and product review and buying guide centered. So we did take some hit in the last couple of years, which sucks. But then again, we entered this niche and authority site model in a way that positions ourselves well. It positions us well to do more than just the acquisition side. Our 12 site portfolio was I like to call it an acqui-hire, because we retained two editors and one SEO manager that are phenomenal talent. That we love working with them, and they've kept up with us as we look to scale. And so they made it easy to get our beak wet on the acquisition side and, build the organization, build some talent, bring in some new editors, bring in some new, a bunch of new writers, build our processes in a kind of a easier way, because it's business, they're, businesses that are running and cash flowing and stuff. So, and we tested a lot of things. We were trying to, drive growth with sites that were already suffering when we acquired them. So we knew they were going to be a turnaround. We just didn't know that they were going to be this difficult to try to turn around. And then the end of 2021, we looked at each other like, there's got to be more to this than just the acquisition side and kind of lagging and dropping revenue. And the buy and build kind of dichotomy was always in the back of our minds. And we met a great advisor that has done the build side four times. He probably has been on the podcast. He's been on multiple other podcasts, but Ewan Finser. And he essentially gave us the keys to his kingdom to help us build out our models. He gave us assumptions on, how many articles do we need to seed each site? How much should we spend per article? What's the maturation rate or pace per month? What type of RPMs can we look at in specific niches? So we built out this massive spreadsheet, essentially a model to forecast how long it would take to mature, 50 sites, 16, then 24, then 50 sites. The assumptions on good, better, best. So each cohort has a good, better, best model on traffic and revenue potential. And then we've started fundraising. We started vetting niches, and things just kind of compounded from there. And right around April, end of April, we had enough money in the, our $1 million goal. We had like 70% raised at that point, and we're like, well, we don't want to twiddle our fingers while we have cash in the bank. So we decided to just launch our first cohort. So we launched our first cohort in June, scaled to 10 editors, 25 writers at that point. And now we're at about 12 editors and 50 plus writers. And we're in our second cohort. Wow. So we have 20 live sites, and we'll have all 50 live by this time next year.
Wow. So how did you fundraise that money to be able to buy these sites?
Well, my business partners put it in half. So they're a majority. Okay. It's a family office that acts like a private equity fund. So, they have relationships. I have relationships that we've tapped. Our advisor, Ewan Finser, has relationships that he's tapped. Actually, a significant amount of our new investors have come from Twitter. I've been, tweeting a fair amount in the last 6 months. Mm-hmm. And actually, most of our editors and writers have come from Twitter too. So I have to say, Twitter's the place to be if you want to, find some investors or grow your following and find good talent to help you grow your site, your single site or portfolio of sites. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to dive in to essentially your hiring process and your processes for the site, because managing even 10 sites is a lot per quarter, but you're getting up to 50. So What kind of processes do you have in place to make sure things run smoothly? What is your role within those processes? And maybe we'll jump into a little bit of the hiring stuff.
Yeah, I've consciously tried to step back and let my leadership team tackle a lot more over the past 6 months. Ever since we started launching the 50-site portfolio, I had to I couldn't be the one instigating everything and managing everything. It would have been impossible even with the first 10 sites. I just couldn't do it. So my leadership team took essentially kicked me out of a lot of decisions and said, "Hey, we'll tackle onboarding and vetting and the processes." So Brian is a fantastic lead editor. He does the hiring, the sourcing and vetting, hiring, onboarding, training for new writers and a lot of some of our new editors. Anna is a fantastic lead editor that does primarily on the editorial side. So content briefs, training, a lot of one-on-one training and group training, quality assurance. We do a ton of quality assurance checks along the way with new writers, existing writers that that are launching new sites, so they're usually unfamiliar with the niche or unfamiliar with the new writers that they have for the site. So I can't take credit for a lot of the stuff we do because my team is so phenomenal. Oh, and then Marco, he's our SEO manager. He's freaking awesome. He primarily helps vet. They all help vet and pick niches with us. They've done this before. They were with the 12 site portfolio that we acquired. They grew that thing into a beast with the previous owner. So their institutional knowledge of what it takes to run content teams, what it takes to produce quality content is the backbone of our organization. So, yeah, I mean they make it incredibly easy to get shit done and get content produced. And so, I give all the props to them when it comes to the content. But building the processes, I'm helpful in that regard. I don't want to force their hand. I've forced some things on them in the past that ended up not working. So I don't want to, instigate that. A lot of times they'll bring me a new tool that they want to test out. We're testing a new tool that I'm really excited about this week. And they build the processes with the editors in mind, with the writers that we have in mind, and with the niches that we select. So, each niche has different characteristics that we need to reshape things and strategize around. And they're really the instigators when it comes to building out processes and streamlining everything. So.
Yeah, so you've obviously got a great team. So then how did you How, what was your hiring process like then to find these people? Obviously, you can find great people like this, or you can potentially find duds.
Yep.
So you want to maybe run through how you did that?
For writers, it's a bit of a crapshoot because there's so like, I mean, we I just checked the other day. I think we have 500 writers that we have yet to vet. So it's sort
Wow.
of you got to build the funnel first. We built this great funnel to bring in writer and editor interest, and then Brian essentially goes through the vetting, the submission of our form, all the data that we collect there. He's been doing this so long, he can weed out the bullshit very easily. And he doesn't even talk to those people. So if he does invite someone to submit test articles, so we do a lot of testing, at least two articles per writer, we're doing a lot of time. If they do get a test from us, it's likely we'll bring them on to, do the test and also do, actual production for us. We don't cut a writer until they've proven themselves they can't facilitate the consistency and they can't communicate or their content is shit. So, or what we're dealing with now is it's AI written. So yeah, that's a little bit of the background. Some of it's we have some ways to facilitate it and processes to improve, but Yeah, that's for writers. On the editor side, it's a lot different. We take a lot of more time to vet and develop relationships with editors. A lot of them have been writers for us in the past and currently, because then they know our processes. They know exactly the type of content that we're looking for. They've established the relationship with us and other team members. So that's an easy, you know, flip of the switch to bring them on as an editor. Early on, I developed the relationship with the newer editors. Some were personal connections, some were from Twitter, some were direct outreach because I've seen their work before, or some I've worked with in the past, that sort of thing. So the editor, I think, is where a lot of niche site operators can invest a lot more of their time and to develop the relationships and the trust they need to act as an operator for the site. Actually, we trust our editors to be the operator of the site because, you know, we're publishing 1500 articles every quarter. You know, our QA team is going through, you know, as much as one by one as possible. But They need to flag things. They need to, you know, work with the writers and establish good working relationships with them and cadences to get the job done in 3 months. So yeah, there's a ton of nuance, but there's so much value in bringing on and establishing a onboarding process, a search process, vetting process that can really weed out the weed from the chaff, especially since there's so much more talent than there is jobs right now. People are getting fired for left and right, and they're falling back to things like writing and development and photography and things like that. So we need to be cautious on who we develop relationships on the writer and editor side.
So how many of them are full-time now? I'm assuming most of your editors are full-time.
We have 100% contractors. We don't work with any W-2 full-time employees. I'm not even a full-time employee technically. We haven't found a writer or an editor that wants to do this as a full-time job yet. There are some that we're working with to bring on potentially as full-time contractors to start, because we're growing, we're doing client work now because people are clamoring for this scaled content production capability that we have. And so we're thinking about flipping the switch to some full-time employees as we scale, but it's just so easy to work with contractors that writers that they want to publish or they want to write 4 articles a week. They don't want to write a dozen or more and have that pressure. And then on the editor side, you know, many of them have existing jobs and or other part-time jobs that they're trying to balance. And we don't mind that. Our only stipulation is get 150 articles done in 3 months. We didn't make that target the first time around, and we probably won't this next time, but we still try to make that quarterly goal for each cohort. And we push them sometimes hard, sometimes we're lax about it, but we need to make this cadence so we get all 50 sites live within our timeline.
So how do you retain your contractors, because the last thing you want, I guess, is a lot of churn with your staff, especially when you're running a big operation like this. So is there, at some point, you can only pay your writers or editors so much before, you know, it starts to eat away at how much you're making at the business. Right. So how are you looking to retain your talent, basically?
Well, we're already paying we're not paying the most per article for writers or editors. But we're paying high enough that they don't feel the need to go searching for another, you know, part-time job or, you know, contractor work. The other thing is our leadership team and me, it's our job to make their jobs easier so that they produce the best content possible. So whatever tool we can use to simplify their work or speed it up, we're interested in doing. As long as quality is maintained, we don't care how long it takes them outside of the 3 month, you know, quarterly, you know, launches. And we're not hounding them to, you know, I think the average pub rate needs to be like a 12 or 13 article per week cadence if they want to make that 3 month mark, but we're not hounding them to make those weekly goals to, you know, so it's very, it's not pressure. There's no pressure to get things done. We give them as many tools that as they need to, you know, be as effective and top quality as possible. And, you know, outside of that, we just leave them alone.
Nice. So how do you decide then what niches you're going to go into? Because you've got a 50 site portfolio. It may make sense to almost do most of that in one niche and to kind of dominate that one niche, or spread your risk as such over multiple niches. So how are you deciding what you're in? How many niches are you in? Are you able to share maybe some of them as well?
Yeah. So niche selection is very different, in my opinion, when you're a portfolio when compared to a solo operator picking one site. We approached it. We knew we were going to be diversified across multiple niches. The only thing we were open to doing, and the reason why one of the good things about launching 10 per quarter is that in our third, fourth, and fifth cohorts, we can look back at the niches that are doing well from the first and second cohort. We have own data then to suggest, okay, this niche is great. What are the some secondary niches or similar niches around it or similar topics around it that we could launch in and own that larger niche or own a genre, if you will. And I can't share what niches we're in. There is one that we may be more open to because it's we're shifting our launch strategy with it because it's such a huge opportunity at the moment. But had we talked about a month and a half from now, I think I would have been more confident in telling you. So maybe I can tweet about it later, So the reason I said the niche selection is different for portfolios outside of or when compared to solo operators picking a single niche is there are a lot more variables that you can play with outside of the own data that I mentioned before, launching, you know, subsequent niches later on. And those are things that can really benefit a brand, an authority site turned brand later on. So we're not building these sites to be, you know, 100,000 page views, 500,000 page views a month, maybe earn $5,000, $10,000 a month in revenue. We want everyone to become huge brands later on. Even if they're not huge, they're medium to large media, you know, companies that we can flip or scale to much greater heights. So when you're a solo operator, you're taught to pick a niche that you are interested in, you have passion around, you have knowledge around, because you're going to do most of the writing. That's fine. I think it's mainly okay to think about, but I think it misses some points. The other two is, you know, for a solo operator, there has to be search volume, and then ad RPMs and affiliate programs, they need to be available so you can monetize later on. Those are like the three or four kind of things a solo operator is looking for. What we're looking for outside of that, outside of expertise for, you know, the niches we're in, is conviction. How high conviction do we have that we're going to get to at least $1,000 in revenue from ads and $1,000 in revenue from affiliates? Because if we can get to 1,000, we know we can get to 10,000. If we can get to 10,000, we know we can get to 50. So how high, it's actually a rating scale that we place on each niche. So we're vetting each niche. We're then rating them against each other through these new decision points. A few other decision points that we go through are opportunity cost, the question of if we don't enter this niche, are we going to regret it in the future? Do we have an unfair advantage? Do we have a moat existing? Do we have a relationship with a brand partner or a new alternative distribution partner? Other moats can be expertise. Do we have an influencer or an expert in this space that we have a great relationship with already, or we can establish a relationship with, and they can be the face, you know, name, image, and likeness for the site, or even a writer, editor on the site. What's the content cost? You know, is it reference content that's cheap to produce and we can get it published as soon as possible and then enhance it later on with experts? Or is it really technical content that we need to overpay for the writer and editor to really crank on quality there? I mentioned diversified traffic sources and timeline. Traffic decay and reinvestment timeline. That's another factor that it's not a huge thing we look at early on in our vetting or niche selection, but it's definitely in the back of our mind is, you know, if it's reference content, maybe we can let it go for 2 years. If it's newer content that get like technical content that gets updated every quarter or every 6 months, then there's added cost there that we have to factor in. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is own data, data from our sites, data from similar niches, data from partners and advisors that we have. That own data is really helpful, especially, and I mentioned you and our advisor investor. He's launched four portfolios. Some of them are themed, and he's in some spaces that we know we want to jump into. And, you know, we may be competitors, but he's an advisor investor in our portfolio too, so he wins either way. So so there's a lot that goes into our niche process compared to maybe a solo operators. And I think the way our process of building out a rating system with all these things in mind, with all these alternative decision points in mind, has been really helpful for us. And so the first cohort we decided on, really, what are the top ones in that system that we built out? And then our second one was, okay, we hit the top. Now, what are the lower ones that are some miscellaneous, maybe some risks that we can take here and there? So each niche we select, we like to select one, maybe two that are miscellaneous. There's no real market for it, or there's an approach to a niche that we want to, you know, take a risk on. So yeah, that was a lot.
Yeah. Are there any niches then that you actively avoid based on your kind of analysis there?
I mean, NSFW stuff, we don't touch. We've been tempted for a while to do some sports betting and, but I've have a little experience in that space, and it's so incredibly difficult. I don't know if we could build. We're firing bullets, so the bullet needs to become big enough and fast enough to make sense. And that space is, yeah. I'm not sure we could in our model make that work. What other spaces? We're pretty agnostic in that. We know we can recruit good talent regardless of the niche we're in, and we know what content, good content looks like. So it's less of a, is there a niche we don't want to, I mean, porn, we don't want to, I mentioned NSFW, yeah. But we have no interest in that. So, I can't think of any that we absolutely wouldn't besides those. So
how are you then, I guess, how do you define good content? Like, what is good content? Because obviously you're doing this at scale, so you've obviously been able to identify, you know, this shouldn't be published, it's not going to help us rank, and this should. So what are the things on the page to you that signifies that content is good and ready to publish on your site?
That's a good question, because there's, for in my opinion, there's different stages of good content. With early sites like ours, when we're firing bullets and then reinvesting in growing into much larger media properties, the first goal is to get indexed, so and get cranking on growth in SERP. And so this is tough because I don't want to say our content is shit when it starts out, but it, like anything, we know it can be improved. So we're focusing on all of the all of the great identifiers of a good piece of content. Solid title, great H2s, subsections that cover the topic in its entirety. And that's actually one of the things we tell our writers is we don't have a word count. We tell writers we don't pay by word. We pay per article. And the only requirement is that you cover the topic in its entirety in the simplest and clearest way possible. Those are the only two requirements we tell writers, or at least, you know, instructions. Great media, so imagery and video, especially if we can do for the niche. We actually have video programs that we start likely the six to nine month mark once we see where the niches lay out in each cohort. Internal and external links that support and add value. I mean, all the classic identifiers of great content. Yeah. That's like the first bar that we want to reach when we publish and mature a site. After that, it's how do we weave, almost looking at it as a product, in a product point of view, how do we weave these 150 articles or more or less into a guided meditation for that niche. So, I mean, I don't know if I can make an example, but it's how do we fill in the gaps of questions that people have in the specific niche? How do we entertain them in ways that they didn't think that a boring niche or a topical niche could help out? How do we bring in expertise that 10x's the value of that content, not just goes into the basic information that someone needs to know to get started, but like the in-depth nitty-gritty that, you know, the intermediate person or the advanced person really needs to know or is clamoring to know. So really weaving that content together in unique ways, but then also, you know, going after new audiences is, you know, how do you build a brand that is all encompassing for one specific individual, one audience target. Mm-hmm. And then from the beginner to the advanced, scale outward to meet those demands. So, yeah.
Well, before I actually go into your, I guess, keyword research and kind of content publishing process there, you mentioned video. Are you doing YouTube on top of these blogs as well?
Yes. And we're dabbling with alternative video like YouTube Shorts, TikTok, Instagram Reels. A lot of the – so actually, I can talk about this. This is fun because the way we think about video is the next stage of that content quality. So we're publishing 150 articles. After we mature it for, you know, 3, 6, 9 months, we see what content for each site is doing well, what sites are doing better than most. So we pick and choose which ones to facilitate this next step of quality or depth with video. And we're actually working on something that I've coined the term minimum viable expert deployment. So what is the minimum amount of information gain and additional media that a site needs to add to an individual piece of content or a you know, wide swath of content to show Google that your expertise is 10xing. Your expertise is getting way more advanced than your competition. So when we work with experts, and this is part of, you know, for our leadership team to dive into delivering or outreach to experts to bring them on, we say, what's the minimum amount we need this expert to do for us to make their work valuable for the site? So in our eyes, the minimum amount an expert needs to provide for us is their name, image, and likeness available on the About Us page and on any page that they touch, meaning if we ask them to edit or contribute to or quote or review 20 articles out of the 150, 20 of the top articles, we need to place their editorial, byline somewhere on the site. So name, image, and likeness on the About Us page, name, image, and likeness on the byline on whatever content that they touch. And then we're going to do at least a 2 to 3 hour interview with them talking about really diving deep into specific topics that weave those articles together. And then we'll cut up those videos and deploy them strategically throughout the content and YouTube and socials and stuff like that. So that's the minimum viable expert deployment that we're working to get to for a lot of these sites. Is if we're going to work with an expert or three experts for a site, we need to convince them, sell them on the idea that they're going to contribute heavily. And this is why they're going to contribute heavily. And then this is going to how much we're going to pay them to do so in most cases. Sometimes they're more than willing to do those three things for free. So
I like that approach because it's almost like the interview and cutting it up, it's almost like doing one big podcast and just repurposing it for all your content, all your social media over and
exactly.
over again.
Yeah, anything to simplify things for, especially for the expert. The expert doesn't have time to do, you know, a ton of work for you. So you got to simplify. You got to give them a batch of articles to review and enhance, or even just at the minimum give some quotes on. You got to give them an easy to do video thing. They don't have the video technology or capabilities most of the time. So just get on a Zoom with them. Even get on a call with them. If it's audio only, the audio's fine too. I mean, that's helpful. So, I mean, you can do quote cards and with audio overlays for video if you want. Those are helpful. So,
yeah, for sure. And I wanted to come back to your content creation process too. Like, I guess a lot of people have different approaches to how they look to publish. It sounds like you're publishing a lot of articles relatively quickly. So you might fill out almost that topical map. Pretty fast, but I guess there's a few different approaches. You can attack the lower competition stuff and work your way up. It could be, you know, attacking even the higher competition stuff first and then working your way down. Is there an approach that you guys use over all your sites?
So the goal with the reason why we chose 150 articles is in my opinion, and in some of the data that we have from our advisors and our own portfolio, is 150 articles in most cases, or I shouldn't say most, in some cases is enough to get to topical authority, at least at a 40,000 foot view of a site. I can talk on why we make that assumption and the data and stuff, but I think that's less interesting than diving into. When you do a portfolio like this and you're not motivated to get the incremental revenue, meaning you're not trying to get to $100 as soon as possible. We don't give a shit about the $100. We give a shit about getting our site to topical authority as fast as possible so that Google knows not to ding us later on. Google knows that we're covering a topic in its entirety. We're not just going after low-hanging fruit. We're not just going after, you know, low keyword difficulty keywords and lists of low difficulty keywords. Man, it's a mouthful. And high search volume keywords. We're going after the entire topical map that is going to get us to topical authority as soon as possible, and that because we can fill out the gaps later on. We can go after those low hanging fruit later on. We think it's prudent to, one, get to topical authority as soon as possible to prevent getting dinged in the as soon as possible, and then fill in the gaps where needed. There are some niches that we find that we don't getting to topical authority takes, you know, 50 articles, and then you can fill in the gaps with 100 low hanging. Ones. There are some niches that the one I'm excited about in this cohort is this new strategy we're working on. But the evergreen content isn't. We can probably get to 150 articles, but we're going to do like 120, 125, and then reserve some of that revenue or some of that cash to do more video and kind of a site launch, if you will, to grow. In other mediums.
Has any of your sites been hit by a Google update? I guess any of the ones you've launched recently? And if so, have you been able to distinguish kind of why some were hit and why weren't? Or why some weren't?
None of our new sites have been hit. At least it's too early to see significant, data to suggest that they were hit. But our current portfolio our acquired portfolio is more plateaued than anything. They were hit 6 months ago, but they bounced a little bit back and then they've plateaued. So the most recent updates, not so much.
Gotcha. And then you've also planned some experiments as well with your current batch of sites that you're releasing. Do you want to maybe dive into some of those if there's anything you've got there?
Yes. Well, okay. So this one where, man, I wish I could say the niche. Because we're in a position with our video capability, we have some video talent on the production side, and we're getting more reps in on convincing influencers and experts to do more video for us. So being, on-camera talent, that a tandem launch of, maybe 150 articles, evergreen articles, and then a 2 to 3 month sprint on social, primarily TikTok, YouTube Shorts, and Instagram Reels, because they're getting so much attention and push right now. And then an early email effort. So those three things, I think, are going to be an interesting launch effort. And then with this niche, we're already having conversations, or we've been introduced to some brand early brand partners that could essentially pay for, continued compound, social effort as well as evergreen content effort. So, and then news. This one is a bit more trending news. So, we'll be doing a bit more a more consistent trending news effort with it as well. So I'm excited to see how those four things kind of work together to launch a site in this same model that we're doing, just, doing video and social and email a lot earlier than we had planned.
Gotcha. So how are your sites monetized other than display ads and affiliate? Is that kind of the model you've gone down, is exclusively that to maybe keep things easy and simple, or are you kind of branching out to other things too?
Yeah, so for this the 50 site portfolio, those are ads and affiliates are the primary. Matt Diggity just did a video on selling sites. Yesterday.
Yeah.
Based on this recording, and he mentioned leaving things for a future buyer to do. So we typically want to just do ads and affiliates, get as much revenue from those, build cash flow and potential sale price, but then leave some other revenue streams on the table. Some ones we've dabbled with are communities, paid communities. We do direct brand sponsorships. We've done even, paid agency work too. Like, DAG will be your agency. We have these sites, we'll deploy native content, sponsored content, email sponsorship, podcasts. So we've played with other revenue streams and done okay. Always can do better, but with this portfolio, it'll primarily be those two until we get to like the 2 to 5 sites where we want to really launch into massive media properties. Then we'll those are the sites we'll keep for 10 plus years. So
do you have a preferred display ad network that you use? Then have you tested, since you've got such a vast portfolio, have you tested different ones?
We've tested all the three major ones. I've never used Google AdWords or AdSense. I don't see the reason why, or I don't see any reason to use it. We lucked out. The 15 site portfolio that we acquired, none of them had monetized through ads, so that was an easy, revenue add for us. Mm-hmm. A few were large enough to go on Mediavine right away. brought one off of Mediavine onto AdThrive, and it's still currently there. And then the rest were deployed on Ezoic. So we're on all three.
Gotcha. Do you have a preference for anyone? Or
see, this is where the dumb drama in the niche site community gets you in trouble. It's like everyone's got an opinion. You know,
I just want to know some, if you've got any data or anything. You know, maybe you've seen something that others haven't because you've got so many sites. It can be prefaced with, you know, this is from your experience.
No, like to be honest, it comes down to like the ease of use because we have so many sites. It's like who's the easiest to deploy, who's the easiest to work with, who gives us, you know, kind of bespoke or handholding once in a while. I like Mediavine's product, like just the interface, but that's a horse in a piece. So AdThrive has the shittiest interface. Mediavine has, in our experience, the better ad rates. Ezoic, I dig what Ezoic is doing, even though some kind of dislike it, but I don't mind Ezoic as much as everyone else seems to dislike them. And I've had conversations with the guys, and they're fantastic. So I'm not a shit poster like some in the community. So
no, fair enough. I wanted to dive into your off-page strategy as well. You've got a huge portfolio. Obviously, it sounds like you put most of your funds into the content creation process, editors, and all that kind of stuff. So I guess one strategy you could think of with having so many sites, if you've got similar niches, it's almost like you're a network of blogs. So one, are you ever linking between sites that you own? And two, what are you doing for off-page?
So we have linked between sites, but we're not really like keen on it just to be safe. Everything we do is about risk mitigation. So the sites would have to be, or the articles would have to be incredibly, we take the same approach like we would with any link opportunity. Is this topically the best thing we could possibly link to? And if it's not, we'll improve it on our one site and then deploy it on the other. But we're not really actively looking for link opportunities throughout the portfolio. It's, you know, if it happens, it happens, and it's beneficial. But we're not also not keen on a link building strategy. We're dabbling with a little paid link building at the moment with some of the sites just to see what opportunities come about. But we've had a lot of success with organic backlinks coming our way, as well as with our experts and partners that we work with. You know, that's an easy ask with an expert. It's like, we're gonna promote you as an expert on our site. Will you give us a backlink from yours? Like, that's a no-brainer. So, that's my opinion on backlinks. So,
nice. And then I guess within those. Oh man, I just had something to ask you on then. I completely forgot about what I was going to ask you around the off-page stuff. But that's all right. Well, I'll move on. I've got some other things anyway. Regarding, I guess, internally linking, you mentioned obviously your internal links as part of your good content as well. Are you, with so many pieces of content being published, how are you looking to internally link, especially to potentially older articles that you've written or even to the newer ones, because maybe, you know, the 100 articles back written 2 weeks ago, completely forgotten about them. So how are you kind of keeping up?
Right. Well, it's a requirement for our editors to add at least 3 internal links on day one for a published article. Our Q&A team goes through and they'll add them or improve them if they're bad choices for internal links. And then we have a cadence for, you know, for every cohort we launch, you know, the 3 to 6 months after it's been launched, you know, in that period of time, we'll have improved, you know, most of the top content. We will have added a lot more links. We do use Link Whisper, even though it's, you know, our SEO manager is so much better at it, doing it one by one, than Link Whisper could, you know, give us. It's been giving us some odd, you know, link recommendations, but it's a process. It's, you know, it's starting from the publishing of the article, making sure that there's at least, you know, some to index things. On the quality assurance side, that's a big one because our top talent, top SEO talent are looking at quality assurance, at quality checks. And then each time we do checks and improvements of the content as they mature, as the sites mature, we're looking at link opportunities. So
nice. And then what is, I guess, next for you in the portfolio in terms of kind of where you are now and kind of where you're looking to go, what you're looking to implement, I guess, over the next few months?
Well, the next few months, we're looking to close our $1 million fundraise. Because we've launched early, I hadn't really been focused on closing the fundraising. So I think we have like 185K left, which we have, you know, 20 people we're talking to at the moment that still have interest, but we definitely want to close that as soon as possible. So, you know, just a selfish plug here, if you're looking at investing in niche sites as an alternative investment, hit me up. I'm ready to chat. Outside of that, I'm excited for this one site launch in cohort 2. It's going to be dope. It's going to be a lot of fun. I'm excited to see, you know, what type of results we get from it, because it could really reshape how we approach portfolios. Not that I don't want to overemphasize that, because it could be shit. So, in December, I'm hunkering down to build out a new model. We're going to be launching Legion Media 2 fundraising effort in probably beginning of Q2, middle of Q2 2023, because with 50 writers, 12 editors and growing, we want to keep that talent as long as possible and continue to launch great portfolios. And so as soon as we're done with Legion Media 1, we want to roll into Legion Media 2, which means we got to have fundraising in and plans for how to improve the model. So
damn, it sounds like a lot. And then as someone's actually interested in investing in your portfolio, what do they get out of it in terms of returns? How does that all work?
Let me pull it up so I don't misquote it. So minimum investment is 25K checks, preferred 50K, but we'll take smaller checks just to get people involved. Our LPs, the way we're incentivized as a as the operating entity, if you will, is on a waterfall. So we earn 10% on the first million in revenue, which is getting people their money back, at least initially. And then the investors earn 90% of the first million, 75%, 25% for the next million. And then anything over 2 million in revenue in earnings and net earnings is 50-50 split between our operating entity and the investors. So yeah, we're really incentivized to make sure this, you know, one, we get people's money back as quick as possible, but two, you know, we make well over, you know, 2-3 million, 4 million. So, and more. if we can get one site to like NerdWallet size, like that's, I mean, that's always the ideal.
Off to the races.
Then we're off to the races. And like, yeah, that's a huge win. I mean, that's a home run. If we get a triple with a site that, you know, sells for 6-8 million just on that one, I mean, that's amazing too. So
nice. And that 50-50 split counts also for when you sell the site in terms of,
yeah, that's site sale, that's revenue coming in from you know, everything. So
awesome. So if anyone's interested, check out Paul on Twitter. Do you want to maybe plug your socials now and so people can find you?
Yeah, it's P-A Lemley. That's P-A-L-E-M-L-E-Y on Twitter. Yeah, that's the best place to follow.
Yeah, nice. I'll chuck it in the notes for the editor to throw in the description too, so people can find you if they need to. But other than that, thanks for coming on, Paul, and sharing what you're up to with your huge multiple portfolios, growing portfolios in this space.
Hey, it was a lot of fun, James. Thanks so much.
Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed the show. Don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you're listening. Until the next episode, goodbye.